This is episode 80 of Ethics and Culture Cast from Notre Dame's DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture. Welcome to episode 80 of Ethics and Culture Cast from Notre Dame's DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture. I'm Ken Hellenius, the communication specialist at the center. In this episode, we bring back friend of the center, Randall B. Smith, to the studio to chat about his book, From Here to Eternity, Reflections on Death, Immortality, and the Resurrection of the Body. We chat about how the incarnation of Jesus Christ instituted a radical new way of understanding the universal experience of death. Let's sit down together for this frightfully hopeful conversation. Well, Randy, welcome back to the podcast. Now, the last time you were here, way back on episode 9 in January of 2018, we talked about your book, Reading the Sermons of Thomas Aquinas. Now, today we're going to talk about your newest book, From Here to Eternity, Reflections on Death, Immortality, and the Resurrection of the Body. So to start off, tell us a little bit about this book. How did it come about?
It started actually when we were in the midst of the pandemic. And I thought, wow, maybe the topic of death would have a bit of a market. You know, people might be thinking about it. But the book came really out of reflections on the resurrection of the body and its significance and how we can understand its significance for us. And so that's something I had been thinking about for a lot of years, actually. And originally, you know, there were, I thought, mistaken views of the resurrection of the body. The most simple one is the, oh, Jesus didn't really die. You know, he was just wounded. And so then he, you know, got up and walked around after that, et cetera, et cetera, which of course is sort of ridiculous. But, you know, people had that view. I then wanted to argue why that view wouldn't, of course, tell us anything about our redemption. Okay. I mean, even if you sort of thought historically that's what happened, that would be, we might say, pointless, right? Like,
yeah,
that doesn't tell us anything. Okay. And there, it seems to me, are other views of the resurrection. Again, one that isn't a resurrection of the body, which would also not really tell us anything important about our redemption. And so, in fact, at the heart of the book is my claim that what we know about the afterlife, okay, about eternal life, or put another way, about heaven, is revealed to us most fully in the person of the resurrected Christ. And what that reveals to us is two things in particular. A, that in the resurrection, in the general resurrection, we will share in the glory and the happiness and the beatitude of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And this is equally important, that we will not lose our personal identity. It will still be us. So in other words, the image which some people sometimes use, which in certain religious traditions might be appropriate to them, but is that idea of the drop of water returning to the ocean. Lovely image in certain ways, but I think it doesn't capture something important because, of course, when the drop of water returns to the ocean, no more drop, right? It just gets glommed into the great, you know, fabric of the universe kind of thing. And that's not the promise, it seems to me, of the resurrection, right? When Jesus is risen, all right, he is now enjoying once again, right, and returning ultimately in the ascension to the glory, to the right hand of the Father. But it is still distinctly him, right? It's right. Not like the story was, this angel appears or angelic figure appears in before the 12, in the upper room, and says, I am the God that was hidden within the man Jesus, who has now been liberated from his body, right? I mean, this would be a kind of Neoplatonists would like that kind of idea. But the point is, that's not what happens, right?
Right.
It's a very distinctly bodily resurrection where he still has those marks of the crucifixion. Anyway, so that's what I argue is at the heart of our understanding of the afterlife.
Yeah. Well, now, you are a philosopher by training, a theologian by trade, and this book actually kind of crosses both boundaries, right?
Yeah, theologian is not much of a trade, but anyway, yeah.
You're a tradesman when it comes to the sign of the cross, I guess.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? We're all, theologians in that sense. So I imagine people would see that combination in the book, right, in a way. Namely, the inspiration, the fundamental thrust of it was, again, a reflection on the resurrection of the body. But it's more of a, broadly speaking, philosophical reflection, right? So I go through, you know, other potential ways of thinking about death and the afterlife, and suggesting what some of the limitations of those views are. Mostly not to criticize, you know, some other religious tradition or other, you know, like I talk about, for example, reincarnation. The issues that I see with that are not ones that you would necessarily associate with, you know, Hinduism. They might. But again, Hinduism may have resources to deal with that. But I think the point is, when people think about, like, what do I want for the afterlife, right? What do I think it would be? Then this is one of those, you know, potentials. And we're seeing this in the United States, where people are like, well, I'm not sure I believe in heaven. Maybe reincarnation would be better. You want to understand what the difficulties of that view are and why the resurrection of the body is not that view. Because essentially, to put it in a nutshell, that's another view, it seems to me, the way we understand it in the West oftentimes, which makes this life meaningless. Again, that's another part of the book, right, is this twofold idea, which is that for most people in most of history, I've understood that you need a notion of the afterlife, or there has to be some afterlife for this life to be meaningful, right? If after everything we've lived and experienced and loved, you know, it's just negated. There's just oblivion. It seems like, well, that's all just meaningless.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you don't want a notion of the afterlife that makes this life meaningless, right? So in other words, if heaven's so great, why don't we just get there, right? Like if everything in heaven just negates everything in this life, well, then why are we wasting our time, right?
Right.
Like here we are, cool on our heels here for a while. Like why? So it seems to me that's the fundamental, we might say, philosophical challenge that you're bringing to your understanding of the afterlife. I mean, and this is important historically for any number of reasons. More recently, obviously, the, you know, the Marxist critique of the notion of the Christian notion of the afterlife is that, oh, here's what you guys are doing. You know, it's the opiate of the masses. You're just convincing these people, well, yes, you're suffering now. There's horrible injustice, but you just suffer it. And then eventually you get to heaven, right? And so, like, you know, throw off your chains right now. Now, I think that's an unfair criticism of Marxism. I mean, it's not like, you know, the history of Christianity was not fighting for justice, you know, or caring for the poor or, you know. So I think that's just silly in its own way. But it is a legitimate, we might say, philosophical critique. Like, is that what eventually happens? Is that what people are thinking? That somehow I live this life and I'm suffering and, yeah, there's injustice. My husband's beating me. But, you know, I suffer it and then I get it, you know, because good stuff will happen in heaven. It seems to me that's a life-denying, you know, sort of view of the afterlife, which I think Christianity should avoid, right? So anyway, there is that combination of like, look, I begin with the idea and don't defend, in a sense, right, the resurrection of the body that way. I just argue why this is an appropriate view and why it's the most meaningful view, I think, of life after death.
Yeah, wow. You made reference to, you know, writing this, getting the idea in the midst of the pandemic, kind of the proximate idea, I guess. But who is the book for? Who were you writing it for?
You, Ken. I wrote the book for you.
Well, I read it, mission accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. You said you read it, and yeah. You may be the only person. So it was, anyway, so now the audience is, you know, just, I don't know, people like me, people I talk to all the time. So, and I'm going to say not specialists, okay,
sure.
In the area, and I didn't. So my inspiration, just to, you know, inspiration, not that I equate myself with these people, were people like Joseph Pieper and, of course, the great C.S. Lewis and Romano Guardini, et cetera, in The End of the Modern World, for example. You know, so books like that that people of all stripes and, you know, around have found extremely helpful. Those were kind of my models and always have been because it's the books I read and the books I like and the only way I can write because I can't do anything else.
You made reference there to experts, not, you know, not writing for experts. Are there experts in death?
The saints, I suppose, right? You know,
sure.
But many of them are not writing as many books as we might like to
at
see
least
from
not
them.
Now,
not yeah. Now. It would be nice, though, you know, like if right. You could have St. John Henry Newman writing another, you know, Grammar of Assent from. But
I mean, because you quote T.S. Eliot several times, you know, East Coker, the poem, among others. Blade Runner makes an appearance.
I sent it to my editor, and one of the proofreaders wrote back, you know, I thought, well, this is kind of funny. And actually somebody else had said Blade Runner, who knows that movie, whatever. And this young woman wrote me back, and she goes, I really like this book. I'll tell you why. On the very first pages, you were mentioned Blade Runner, and I thought, oh, I'm going to like this book, you know. So some people are like, Blade Runner, why would he put that in there? And other people are like, oh, I like that Blade Runner. Anyway, yeah, no, Blade Runner makes it.
It does. And a rather appropriate reference, too, I thought, too.
Yes. Yeah. No, it is that notion that, for the people who don't know, there's a scene at the end of Blade Runner. This isn't, anyway, where a character dies, but there's this whole speech about, like, all this stuff. I've seen things, he says, you people wouldn't believe. And he goes on a bit, and he goes, and all that now is going to be lost, like tears in rain. You know, it's a little, but, and the point is, like, well, is that what happens, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people think it's like this whole thing. I've seen things. I've built company. I have grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I say to people, look, I think the thing that people most fear about death, in my experience, not everybody, you know, like, but is the loss of their loved ones.
Yeah.
Right? That somehow they're abandoning their loved ones, you know, and that it's but I think that's where the hope of the resurrection of the body comes in, is that we don't lose this connection, that, and not only resurrection of the body, but the related idea of the communion of the saints, is that we don't lose our loved ones. We get them back in an even more glorious way, right? Any more than, like, Jesus is kind of like, well, Jesus is leaving now, and so he's gone forever, right? And that's okay. We're done. Okay. You know, like, he's like, heaven is like going to Cincinnati or something, you know, and you're living in Houston and you're like, okay, well, you know, well, maybe someday I'll visit him in Cincinnati. As I've said several times to people since the book, I said, this is one of the tragedies, it seems to me, of losing that sense of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, actually, which is that that visible, physical, tangible, you know, belief that Christ can be as really present to us now as he was when he was on earth, you know, walking around in the Holy Land, and as present, right, as he was in the upper room when they touched him and ate with him, et cetera, et cetera. If you can believe that too, right, that of course. But again, you know, he's as really present there as he was during life. If you don't believe he's as really present to us now as he was during his earthly life, if you sort of think, well, he's spiritually, we remember him. Well, of course, then you're going to lose that sense that your dead grandmother, beloved, you know, uncle, whatever, can be present to us as really present to us as he was during his life. You sort of think, well, you know, there's those scenes in Hollywood movies where somebody goes, well, Mama, how can, you know, she gone? And somebody says in this romantic way, she'll be alive as long as we keep her in our heart, you know, and the point is, like, that just means she's dead, right? Gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really there. And of course, I actually think there's something somewhat potentially abusive about that, in the sense that if my beloved grandmother or mother is only living in my memory, well, then days go by where I don't think about my mother. My mother did die a long time ago, actually, you know, when I was still just finishing college. And, you know, I mean, it just, life goes on, right? I mean, I do remember my mother, and I pray, actually, I do. I pray for my mother every day I go to Mass. But, you know, hours and hours and hours go by. And so the point is, like, if my mother's only living in my memory, then, you know, there's a huge amount of time where she's dead. And of course, people have this terror, of course, you know, where they think, I can't remember my mother's face. You know, it's just like, look, your mother is alive, okay? She's not only living in you somehow, right? She's living in and through, right? I mean, again, God, your mother can be present to you, it seems to me, not only next to you, like she was bodily during life, but in you and outside of you and in union with God and praying for you even more directly than she did during life. And I think that's, right, again, that's the kind of hope, I think, that the Christian message should inspire in people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the points that you repeat throughout the book is that any compelling understanding of death will display a continuity, as you say, quote, between one's view of human nature and human flourishing in this life and one's view of the ultimate end for mankind after death, end quote. Can you unpack that a bit for us? Why is that true?
Well, again, to go back to the central point, I think that you can't have a notion of the afterlife that makes this life meaningless. And I go through a number of cases of that, you know, famously, mostly from classical literature. It's very interesting, the Iliad and the Odyssey, because in the Odyssey, Odysseus makes a journey to the underworld and to Hades and meets Achilles, the great hero, and says, they're all just shades. They're not, there's no bodily resurrection. He sees his mother, and she says, you can't. It's not. He uses this interesting term, themis, which is divine order. It's not possible. And then he sees Achilles, and he says, oh, Achilles, you're worldwide famous. You're the most great hero. And Achilles says, better to be a slave of a penniless farmer in life than dead. Which, of course, in a way, that whole Greek ethos, right, of the Greek hero and of, you know, gaining fame and glory, in some senses, undermined completely in that thing. And you want to say, look, if that's true, why would you then ever make the choice that Achilles made? Because Achilles could have gone home. Actually, people don't realize that. He's actually given a choice. You can go home and live a long life and not have any kind of fame or glory, or you can stay and fight, and but then you'll have a short life and it'll be a glorious life, right? But it just seemed to me that, you know, again, you don't want a notion of the afterlife that somehow makes the sacrifices of this life ridiculous or meaningless. And again, I argue this with the Roman view. Even Virgil, Aeneas goes to the underworld, okay, because he's redoing the Iliad and the Odyssey in his own way. And he sees all these heroes, you know, in the Elysian fields. Well, but from the Roman point of view, right, who would tolerate a bunch of great heroes, Roman heroes, just sitting cooling their heels in some paradise while all the rest of us are fighting and fighting and fighting for the glory of Rome? Which is why, in fact, as people don't oftentimes pay attention to, at the end of that scene, Aeneas' father, Anchises, takes him to a river. And there's a whole bunch of people gathered around this river. And, of course, Aeneas says, who are these people? And he goes, oh, well, yeah, these are the souls that are going to be reincarnated as the great future. You know, like, oh, there's Julius Caesar and there's Caesar Augustus. And they're going to be reincarnated. So, but they have to cross the river Lethe first, right, just the river forgetfulness. And then they'll become these great heroes of the future, which just tells you, like, yeah, again, it's a notion of the afterlife, which no one can really tolerate. You just have to keep coming back, right, to keep getting the glory of Rome going, right? Because again, if you're in Rome, if you're Aeneas or you're reading the Aeneid at the time of Caesar Augustus, you're like, what, so these guys just go off and drink wine and sit around and we're here fighting for Rome? And the point is like, no, they'll come back, right? They'll come back and do their part. Don't worry, you know? It's like, again, it's a notion of the afterlife which undermines, right, your notion. So the most obvious example in a way is like if you say, you should live a chaste life and, respect women, et cetera, et cetera. See, then after you're dead, well, then you get sex with 76 virgins. And the point is like, well, wait a minute, why am I living this life now so I can live a totally, you know, different life later? So you don't want a notion of the afterlife, which again, that's why, I mean, in the Christian context, it would be true if Marx were right, he's not, you know, that if what it meant to go to heaven was like, oh, we just abandon, you know, all the injustices in this world, just go to the next world and you're happy, right? And then we just suffer. Again, you know, like you met their grandma saying, I'm going to heaven, but all my grandchildren and everybody here, well, goodbye, good luck, you know, keep warm and well fed, right? It seems to me that undermines, you know, the Christian ideal.
Well, now, you leverage your Thomistic expertise in this book as well, particularly by referencing an Advent sermon delivered by Aquinas in chapter 6. So, you know, I've always said, write once, deploy everywhere. So we saw a little bit of your previous book.
Yeah, use it as much as you can every time you can, then you don't have to read more books, right? You
know. Exactly. But yet you also employ the method of St. Thomas, I think, in that the first portion of your book presents, as you've just kind of hinted there, alternative approaches to death. And you do a good job of explaining them in, you know, kind of in their best possible forms before you discuss the Christian approach and how it surpasses the others. Now, what for you were some of the more interesting or intellectually attractive non-Christian approaches to death that you considered in your writing?
We could not have a notion of the afterlife, and we could just ignore the issue of death, which is what I think we do mostly in our culture. And I trace that also to the Epicureans, right? It's kind of like, well, death is nothing, so why even worry about it? Okay. And then you could, like Martin Heidegger, you say, well, no, we should live towards death, right? We should always have an awareness of it, et cetera, et cetera. But again, with no notion of the afterlife. These are positions I think don't really take you much of anywhere, although I think they're common in the modern world in various and sundry ways. Then I pick up this transhumanist idea, right? The idea that personal immortality, right, which has beguiled the human race ever since the ancient Greeks and Romans. I mean, you know, throughout history, like, can you live forever? Just extend life on and on and on. The interesting thing, it seems to me, about the ancient world, which, again, I like classical literature because there's a great wisdom which is preserved. But, you know, they talked about this potential, which they, you know, they would tell stories about, like, oh, yeah, here's a person. It's always portrayed as a very bad choice, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
And the famous one, again, for people who like T.S. Eliot, is the Sibyl at Cumae, right? So when Aeneas goes to make his trip to the underworld, he has to go to Cumae and see the prophetess of Apollo who's there, called the Sibyl. By legend, this doesn't show up in the Aeneid, but she had asked for eternal life, which she was by the gods, and she was granted. But she forgot to ask for eternal youth. And so she just got older and older and older until she was so shriveled up. She was supposedly like hanging from a jar or a, you know, some kind of pendulum from the roof of the cave. And at the beginning of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, he quotes from the Satyricon by Petronius, and it says, and the young boys would say, Sibyl, Sibyl, what do you want? And she replied, I want to die. Anyway, this idea of eternal life is always portrayed as a very bad. You see it in Swift's Gulliver's Travels with the Strudelbugs, all right, these characters who go on and on and on. And anyway, but we have this idea, right? And again, it seems to me that this is a very foolish wish. You do not get, I mean, even apart from the scientific technical problems involved, you do not get new life, right? Unless the old moves on. Somehow, if people realized, yes, aging and going on, having children, et cetera, is part and parcel of what it is to have new growth in the world, right? Then they would understand something about, like, look, this isn't a disease. This isn't, a, you know, this is a natural part of life. Because, again, I mean, there's just an obvious thing, right? If everybody lived forever and then had two children, three children, four children, right? Pretty soon, before long, right? I mean, you know, people worried about overpopulation now.
Right.
Right. You're talking about, like, you know, so then all you want to say is, okay, so we're going to have the people we have now, none of whom is allowed to have children, okay? That would be the world you're talking about, okay? In which case, again, you're sort of saying, so I'm going to live for 500 years, no sex ever, right? Okay, is that a desirable fate to have humanity suffer? And again, it seems to me the answer is no, right? So once you start reflecting on that and you start reflecting on, for example, the love you might have for your children or grandchildren, you realize what you want for them is to be able to go through those cycles, right? As children grow up and then have their own children and see them grow up, at, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But for that to happen, right, the old growth has to move on. Now, again, the hope in Christianity is, I mean, that's just sort of philosophically, logically. The hope in Christianity is that, again, after death, we don't lose that connection. It's not just oblivion. It's not just, you know, being plowed under, as it were, so that the new growth can come. So there's something spiritually which is like that, right? The moving on, but then not losing that contact. That's, again, why I think it's important to understand the resurrection of the body. Not only for the bodily aspects, which are important, but also for that notion of not losing our connectedness to this world and to the people we love and the communities we love.
Something that you reference, but you don't kind of get into in your book, is an idea of the importance of the body as revealed in the incarnation itself.
Yeah.
In Christ not only showing us that death is part of life, because he does die, mm-hmm. but that he is, and you kind of hinted this at the very beginning, that he, in the person of Christ, the resurrected Christ, is also a sign of what is going to happen to us. Not just a sign, but a reality.
Yeah, and this goes back to the previous point you were making. If you think, as Neoplatonists do, right, if the afterlife is shucking the body, right, and going on somehow, well, what does that tell you about our embodied existence in this life, right? Yeah. It tells you that your body is merely a shell, unimportant, unrelated to who you really are. So yeah, you could, this again, as we move into a more Gnostic phase again, the idea that you can just shuck your body and put on another body. Okay, there's a show you may know, Altered Carbon, where this, you know, and there's a number of science fiction shows which have this idea, right? That like, well, I'll just put on a new body, right? And of course, the transgender movement has this idea as well, right? Like, well, sure. I could just change my body out, and that, what would that change necessarily? The transhumanist movement has this idea as well, right? Well, we could download our consciousness, if that were possible, into some nice different hardware and, you know, live forever. This is a popular view throughout history, which Christianity has always stood against. The notion somehow our bodies are, we both think of them as way more important than we probably should and way less important than we probably should, right? Right? Like we care so much about how we look, but then we think the body is just something that you can toss away and get a new one or something like that, right? As opposed to thinking that, no, I have an embodied existence. I have an incarnational, or to put it, a sacramental existence. That is to say, my body, as all matter, right, on the Christian understanding, is meant to be understood as an instrument of God's love. So the embodied nature of the thing is not unimportant, as Pope John Paul II always said in his Theology of the Body, right? We communicate to others, we care for others in and through our bodies. We are not disembodied spirits, nor are we meant to be disembodied spirits. Again, it's very funny when people think about this, like, oh, you leave your body behind. I always think, oh, and I had a student once. I tell the story about having a student once. He was great. He was kind of a surfer dude guy, you know? And he was like, Professor Smith, like, what if the whole point of life, like, you're just trapped in a body, your spirit trapped in a body, and the whole point of life is to find the key to get out? And I said, well, look, if you had that view, then you should be about your business. Because if you had that view, there'd be nothing worse than being on your deathbed and realizing, oh my God, I didn't get the key. I said, but if you're asking me, which I guess you are, like, I quite like having a body, right? Now, I have this body in the way it is, but I like hugs, I like smell, I like taste. Right, I like all the elements of embodiedness, and I have no desire to leave all that behind. Again, the notion that, like, that if you're just a pure spirit or something, that you somehow you keep all these embodied things, it seems to me, is wrong. I mean, again, there's a whole spirituality, it seems to me, of that Gnostic spirituality of, again, which is a redemption from creation, an escape from the problems of embodiedness, whereas the incarnation is a view of like, no, this is a redemption of the created order, yeah. Right? We come here, we live embodied existences. That's not part of sin, right? The only reason that ends up being the way it is right now is because of sin. But our embodied existence is not something that we shuck and leave behind any more than this world is something we shuck and leave behind, any more than the people we love, the people that we've produced. Again, when you're Gnostic, one of the things, for example, when Augustine was a Manichae, one of the things you're not supposed to do is have children, because you just create more embodied beings. And as we get more and more Gnostic, again, it's kind of like, why would you have children, bring them into this horrible world with all its travails, et cetera, et cetera? Christians would say, well, because that's a glorious gift of life.
Right.
And all these things are part and parcel of what it is, right? You know, but again, if you have a notion of the afterlife which says this is all just evil stuff which we have to put aside, well, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. But again, then it makes it hard to understand why you would devote yourself. I argue this about Plato in a way, you know, there's, I think, a disconnect even there. Why would you devote yourself to the city if after this life, you just shuck it all off and go away?
Yeah. Well, now you write, an intellectual approach to the challenge of death is not enough. Christians will need to develop certain habits and engage in various practices, including communal practices, if they are to be helpful and provide the needed consolation and peace. So what are some of these practices that you think we need to recover or perhaps even invent anew?
Yeah, I say at the beginning of the book, I think it's really important. It's kind of like, will this book help?
Yeah, or why this book is not enough,
I think. And it's also part and parcel of why people are like, oh, should I give this book to, you know, people who are dying or you know, like old people? It seems to be a big thing, you know, like, oh, I'm going to give this to my grandfathers. It's like, no, this is not a how-to book, okay, right? About death. It's not just when you're 2 weeks from death when you ought to be thinking about the nature of the resurrection of the body, right? And death, that's one of the problems, it seems to me, in society, is that we put it away from ourselves. We've put it into a room. We've sterilized it, right? We've secularized it in various uncertain ways. And what that ends up doing is making it really terrifying. Now, I say in the beginning of the book, two things, right? Why the book is not enough, and B, and I'll start with B, right? Why I'm not the person to have written this book, in a sense, because you'd expect somebody who writes this book on this to, you know, like work through these issues, and it's also now he's very comfortable, and like, no, I am totally creeped out by the idea of death. I don't like walking through cemeteries. When I was in graduate school at the University of Notre Dame, I lived just off campus, so I had to walk by the Cedar Grove Cemetery every day on my way to campus and on my way back. And cemeteries had always creeped me out throughout life, and funerals always creeped me out through my life. I was not raised Catholic, and I was sort of nominally Protestant. Anyway, but I was very much the American society, which is like, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to face it. Anyway. The other thing I say, and I'm like, why this book is not enough, is it's not just an intellectual issue, right? It's not a question of getting your mind right. I argue that, so how can we deal with this? And the answer is the way the church always deals with these things, liturgically, right? Embracing it. And part of then the argument is, the general sort of claim is that we need to bring this more deeply back into the church in a way that somehow it's fallen out of, right? And I make the example with weddings, you know, again. So there's a whole falderal about weddings, but that actual sacramental part of it becomes kind of a sidelight, you know, like, oh, we need a priest, I guess, don't we, you know? And then, of course, eventually people think, well, why do I even need that, right? Okay. But I think that if churches wanted to get back the faithful, they would take this on. They would say to themselves, no, we do this, right? This is the thing we do, okay? So that when somebody dies from the community, they say, no, let us take care of this, right? And so a simple coffin, but everything should be done liturgically within the church, right? The visitation of the body, right? Now, again, when you had homes and people went to homes and they had parlors, et cetera, that, I guess, would be great. But again, even then, only rich people could do that. So this notion of a funeral parlor or funeral home, which is nothing like an actual home, again, creepy to me, but that's, I mean, granted, everything in this is creepy to me. But it just seems to me that when I've experienced it within the context here at Notre Dame, right, in the context of the Basilica, when my friend John Malone died and the visitation was in the Basilica, powerful,
yeah,
very important, right? And liturgically, I remember going to a liturgy, one of the Orthodox liturgies of Father Khalid, after his wife's father had died. It was about a month after, and they were remembering, and I thought, this is a beautiful, beautiful liturgy, remembering, you know, all the things. And I thought, the only tragedy here is he's not here to experience it. Now, I believe in the communion of saints, he is, don't get me wrong, but I just mean, like, as a process of, you know, to hear all of that as somebody's in the process of dying. And then in the book, I talk about liturgies, which are being resurrected now. You had mentioned to me this issue of the good death. And I think that's all very, very good. I just think, again, I kept with the general principle that the church has to say to itself, this is something we have to embrace, right? We're not contrary to the medical, but we've let it just become something medical, right? When we should, the hospice movement, in some sense, is understood that it isn't it's beyond medical at that point. And the church has to say, yeah, we understand that. Wait, we have to be present here. We have to, again, I think there would be nothing better that you could do for a family like a bereft husband or wife who's lost a spouse after all this time than to simply say, this is not a time for you to have to make a bunch of decisions and worry about all this kind of stuff, right? We will take over what needs to be done in terms of this, right? Now, again, not that they would have their own funeral. Like, I actually know a guy who runs a funeral home, you know, business, and he's part of this. He says, yeah, no, I wish we could do this, right? Like, it's not like he wouldn't have a job. Somebody needs to go to the hospital. Somebody needs to take the body. Somebody needs whatever. But all the rest of that stuff that we've gotten into, you know, where you embalm and et cetera, none of that needs to be done. Simple wooden coffin, et cetera. Church could say, we can afford this. Right, we can do this. And then I argue for the restoral of churchyards, right? That people should be able to bury their relatives in the church where they go to Mass. So every week they see, and this would be an important visual symbol, both of the resurrection of the body and the communion of saints, that constantly people are all around them seeing this symbol of this connectivity. And in that way, it seems to me, you would get out of the thing that I suffer from. You know,
I was going to say, you would find this fantastic to go to Mass every week then,
yeah,
right?
No, exactly, because I have to walk through a churchyard. But when I was in England and you have these places that have churchyards, it's not so creepy because you're walking to, you know, a lovely church in the middle of it. And you think, yeah, all around are the people who are from this community and they
the
can do this, right?
Saints.
And so look, yeah, I personally, okay, do find this creepy, but that's because I grew up in a culture where it's creepy, right? And the
and
only
it's
time
shunted aside, and it's shunted aside,
and it's something weird. And the only time we actually usually sort of see this is in vampire movies and stuff, you know. And I grew up watching vampire movies, and so it just scares me in a way, as opposed to seeing that as just a joke kind of thing. But the reality is, you know, this is our church, and these are our relatives who visually surround us, but, you know, what we believe is spiritually they are, you know, really present here with us in important ways. And again, that belief that we have been given a gift by generations that came before us that we have to make ourselves worthy of because we need to pass on that gift to future generations is a thing which is embodied powerfully, it seems to me, in that symbol of the churchyard, which again, once you lose, as we get more Gnostic, people are like, yeah, let's just get, you know, $10 trillion worth of debt and pass it on to the future because we'll just be dead.
Well, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
I've been writing and am continuing to revise an introductory textbook on the moral life called Christ and the Moral Life, which is a way of thinking about the Christian moral life by asking the fundamental questions that Pope John Paul II talks about at the beginning of Fides et Ratio. Who am I? Where am I from? Where am I going? What about death? But, you know, what, is there something after this life? What's true happiness? Anyway, these sort of fundamental questions. So I have tried to go through and, you know, pose for readers these fundamental questions, and it's a kind of guided reflection through that. But as an introduction, right? I mean, in other words, you ask those questions. And then you want to say, well, here's how the Catholic Church approaches those questions, right? If you could sum it up in two sentences, which you can't in a way, but okay, it would sound something like this. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself, okay? So I then go through how I think the Catholic Church approaches those questions, questions like embodiment. What's the role of the emotions in the human life, et cetera, et cetera. And then through the virtues, the natural law, you know, in some ways, but approach it in a way, I think, which is very different.
Well, Randall B. Smith, author of this fine book, From Here to Eternity, Reflections on Death, Immortality, and the Resurrection of the Body. Thank you so much for coming to be with us. Thank you for writing the book for me, I have to say.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, it was, I mean, it's good that you read it since I wrote it for you. It would have left me with a deep sense of emptiness if for some reason I was like, Ken, have you read the book I wrote for you? And you were like, it's just been busy, you know, which is true for a lot of people who buy the book.
I'm trying to push off thinking
book.
About death.
Yeah,
actually.
No, exactly. Well, then again, I understand that. That's true. It's kind of like, I do hope that people reading the book in some ways, it would give them a bit of peace. But I do then, as I've mentioned, I do argue that, like, look, in the end, that you, it's got to be embraced by a community, right? It's a thing that's, that a community does, and liturgically and within the church. And so, you know, the notion that somebody just goes off individually and reads a book, like a self-help book or something, you know, which this is definitely not. And then like, okay, now I'm prepared. I just don't think, again, that's why I just, this book is definitely not enough. I hope it gives people a certain amount of peace, but that's just not enough. The intellectual has to be then embodied in, again, social practices and social virtues and, you know, sacramentally. There, that's the way the church has always dealt with things. And we've lost that here.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm sad. That makes me sad. But it makes me very happy to talk to the great Ken Eleni.
Well, thank you kindly for being with us.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you to Randy Smith. In the show notes, you will find a link to his book, which people are dying to get, as well as our previous conversation about the sermons of St. Thomas Aquinas. Subscribe to Ethics and Culture Cast so that you can always get the latest episodes by visiting ethicscenter.nd.edu/podcast. We would love your feedback. Please review the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And email your suggestions to cecpodcast@nd.edu. Our theme music is I Dunno by Grapes, licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution License. We'll see you next time on Ethics and Culture Cast. Until then, make good decisions.